Wow. I don't know about you. Well, I do know about you. You probably feel the same way as I do. You never feel worthy in the least to be standing before such a people. And especially after conversations you have with people. I was talking to Julio before I came up here, and I'm just listening to his story, and I am like thinking, oh, this guy is an amazing person, and I'm not. But you know, I started thinking about this. I started thinking about even you all individually, and then as I started to think about some of you individually, I started to really feel pretty inferior. I don't know why, but for me, I think I know why. It's obviously because I know my own inadequacies, but these meetings are always such a roller coaster for me. You know, you're up one minute, you know, all encouraged, and then next minute you feel like you got, you know, you're so inadequate, and you're just up and down, and you know, it's like, what do I have to give? And I know my prayer, as many of you I know have been praying for me also, and my wife and other people, just is that if this is what God would have me to do, then I'll do it. If not, I'll get skipped. And I know I was told yesterday that I was probably maybe going to go yesterday if we had time. That didn't work. I was told today if we had time, you know, that would work out. And I guess it worked out. And so I know there's a scripture in Isaiah, and I'm not going to read it for the sake of time because I said I had maybe an hour, so I want to try and stick to that. But in Isaiah 6, 5 through 8, you know, Isaiah's lips, or the writer's lips, are touched by God. And then he basically says, you know, here am I, send me. And, you know, for all of us, God touches our lips. He touches our lives in different ways. And we're called in his kingdom to do things. And as we are, we respond, you know, here am I, Lord, send me. We would be content to be doorkeepers, you know, but that's really all we are. At the end of the day, it's just doorkeepers, just humble men and women who care for a cause that's much greater than ourselves, you know, willing to keep the door if that's what the calling is, or at times willing to do much more. And never exalting ourselves above the cause, you know, because that can be easy to do through our pride. But, you know, when we keep ourselves humble, we realize that I'm just a cog in the wheel. I'm nothing special. And I know for me, this life was ingrained in me from birth, as many of you in this room today have the same story as me, raised in the church. And I think when you're raised in the church, you constantly get compared to your parents, you know, because you, obviously the comparison is there to draw. So people say, oh, you sound like your father, or you look just like your mother, things like that. To me, I still get called John from time to time, and I just let it go. It's like, I don't correct it. You can call me what you want. But, you know, for me, from my youth, this was the work that I knew I was called to, as we all have. And the work of the Lord was on my heart from a young age. I remember as a kid, I would prepare sermons as a child, and I would give them, you know, at our family Bible lessons. We had worship in our home for some time, and, you know, we would stand behind the pulpit and have Bible classes, you know, as you know, with my brothers and sisters. I have recordings of my mom does, of me when I was probably 5 or 6 years old. My grandma had moved to Albuquerque to help the church there, and we used to take tapes, and we would record ourselves talking to her, you know, and then send her, you know, just a message from us. And, you know, there's recordings of us singing her songs, you know, God's songs. I was recorded just reading her the scriptures and telling her, you know, Grandma, this book is precious. These pages are precious. You have to be careful with them when you turn them. It was just the mindset that was put into me. And I remember distinctly, I don't know why, but in third grade, I was out at recess with one of my friends, and my best friend at that time was a girl. Her name was Alicia. She actually broke my leg playing soccer one time. But I remember the bell rung, and we're walking into to our classroom, and I told her, I was like, I can't wait till May week. And she was like, yeah, me too. And she had no clue what May week was. To me, it was like a holiday, you know, it was a special thing. But, she just responded with what she did, which was interesting enough. But, and then in sixth grade, we were asked to write about what we were going to be when we grew up. And, of course, I wrote down that I was going to be a preacher. And my career choice, even as I chose my career, it was made with my future in mind, knowing that I was going to be a Christian and knowing that one day I'd have to pick up and move. And I wanted to do something that I could take anywhere because, you know, God comes first. And so since a boy, my desire has always been to serve in his kingdom. And, you know, becoming a Christian has proved, you know, to be a lot more than what you think it is as a boy, you know. So it's kind of this fantasy land, and then reality hits you as you become a Christian. It's a lot different work than perhaps you thought it would be. But really, I want to just start off by maybe giving an update on our move to Erie. Because that's not really necessarily what my lesson's about. I actually struggled with this lesson just because it's like I felt like I had, you know, I was going 1,000 different directions. I felt like it probably won't make a lot of sense. But I also just realized I just have to lean on God and let him do his work, and I'll just be his mouthpiece. But last year at this time, I knew there was a good chance we were going to be going somewhere for my wife's health. I didn't know where. My thought was that we would be going somewhere west. That was my hope. I had said before, and I think I had mentioned this in November, that I've said before that I would never want to move to Erie. That's one place I'd never want to go, and I did. And so last year at the meeting, I was talking in the hallway with Doug Williams, and I think Jeff had come up, and he mentioned just how, you know, there might be a need in Erie, and he mentioned about me going, and I just was like, I didn't really take him serious, and I just jokingly said, huh, not me, you can send Doug there, Doug can go. Little did I know that was going to be me. And I just thought that there's some of you who sit in this room right now who, you know, this year your name tag says whatever it says, and next year it's going to say a completely different congregation, and you'll go through a life-changing experience. And my last year has been quite a year with a move and with different health issues that I've had to deal with for the first time. It's been kind of a whirlwind. But through the whole thing, I've seen God work. We saw God work even in our move to Erie. There was plenty of times we tried to buy a house in San Antonio, and it just didn't work out. And so we ended up, you know, having to just rent. And now we know why. And it wasn't because we didn't have the money. It wasn't because we didn't have good credit. Everything was in line. God just wasn't allowing it to be. And so last year, as we were leaving May week, I didn't even know Trent, really. I mean, I've known him, just like I know many of you by greeting you, but I didn't really know him. And as we were leaving May week last year, Trent was leaving, he just patted me on the back, and I was thinking, what is that all about? and I think maybe he had an inkling as to why. And so we ended up packing our bags and moving to Erie, and of course our welcome gift when we got there, I think, was a snow shovel. And we got quite the welcome, as many of you know. We got a pretty big snowstorm or snowfall this winter. Typically, Erie averages 100 inches of snow per year, which is a lot. And this year, we got 198. So it's basically double what we're used to. And so, obviously, I don't know why God did that. Trent says it was his going away thing. Maybe it was my welcoming, maybe both. But it's been quite a transition. Totally a culture shock compared to what I'm used to. Growing up in California and then in Texas for a long time, I was used to cities with a lot of growth and new construction, things that were kind of moving in an upward direction. And Erie is a lot different. It's an older town. It's not growing a whole lot. People are moving away from it, and you can tell, you know, by looking at it. But one of the things that we're learning as a congregation there, because the church is growing since our move there, not because we are anything special, but that's just part of life. As change comes into play, we all grow in different ways. And one of the things that we're learning as a congregation is just Christianity is becoming a lot more personal to us. You know, we're learning as a congregation why we do what we do. You know, just like we're talking about with our discussions, you know, it's easy to just follow protocol and to know, okay, this is what we do in this situation, this is what we do in that situation, but to really learn the why. And that's one of the things we found is as June and Trent left, you know, they were there for 14 years. They guided the congregation well, left us with the congregation in good hands. The brethren there are really neat. I really enjoy them, and it's a great congregation to be a part of. But one of the things we found is that, you know, a lot of times brethren would maybe counsel about a lot of things, like little things, you know, stuff that maybe they could figure out on their own. And so it was like, let's learn how to reason for ourselves in some of these things. Let's learn why we do what we do. And it's been a neat work, just really growing in that way. We've been growing close as a body. Everyone's learning to pitch in. It's been quite the collective effort. And we recently had our first baptism since we've been there. Our new brother's name is Zach. He was raised in the church, but he's had quite the situation growing up. His parents kind of separated, and father fell away, and he stopped coming for a while, as did some of his other siblings, but he recently started coming back around, and in early January, me and him started meeting up once a week at Starbucks or at Barnes & Noble, and we would just meet, and at first, it was more so, I'm looking at the city, I've heard that we haven't had a baptism from the work in I think it's been close to 4 years now, and you know, just seeing that the city doesn't seem like it's maybe going to be as fruitful, and I told Thomas, our other brother there, or one of our other brothers, I said, there's our next baptism right there. Let's start working with him, because Zach had started coming around, and, you know, let's try and draw him in. So I asked him if he wanted to go out to coffee, and he said, yeah. And so we met up, and I figured it was just a one-time thing, just kind of start breaking the ice, get to know you. And so we talked about different things. We talked about football, which is what he liked. He likes the Vikings. And so we started talking about sports a little bit and just getting to know him. And the next Tuesday, I was planning on going out to personal work, and he texts me and says, are we meeting up tonight? And, well, I wasn't planning on it, but, yeah, we're meeting up tonight. So ever since then, we met up every night or every week for probably about 4 months. And then one day he came up and said that he wanted to get baptized that coming week. And that was really, really encouraging for us, you know. And Zach has been really awesome for the congregation in a lot of ways. He's zealous, and he's in there, but he's really been good for the kids too, which has been nice. He's brought a lot of life to the congregation. And his brothers that had not been coming, who were maybe at times in the past caused a little bit of trouble, have been starting to come around on their own. In fact, this past week, their fallen away father dropped them off because they asked him if he would take them to worship. And so it's been neat to see some of the growth so far, and we hope for much more. My hope is that we can really have somewhat of a youth movement there, you know, and just kind of get a lot, because we got a lot of teenagers there, and just really getting them involved in the church there. And it's, so far, it's going well. So some of you have asked how I like it there, and I've said that I have to be careful what I say. Right, Shelley? Because people in Erie like Erie. So I might not necessarily have chosen the location. that God has called me to be. But I love the church and there, and I'm excited about the work there. The brethren are very genuine and extremely teachable and moldable. And I thought that we're small as a congregation, but we're kind of further out from a lot of people. Yet really just focusing on pleasing God. And I really enjoyed Stuart's lesson, just the power of godliness, just really learning that it's truly just me and God. It doesn't matter where I serve him. I don't need to be around a bunch of other congregations. I don't need to be around a bunch of my friends necessarily. I can serve God anywhere. And so I've been excited with that renewed mindset. Even because we kind of have a divide in Erie of we got like a 55-plus crowd, and then we've got a 35-ish and down crowd. We don't really have any middle-aged people. And so it's really, even Jack's talk with some of the things he shared kind of inspired me to just really want to bridge that gap more and have the young ones really be a part of ministering to our older ones, even though they're not maybe elderly just yet. We know we don't have people in nursing homes or anything like that, but it will be there maybe in the next 10 years. And so really wanted to build those bonds. And so the song that we sing, "Does the place you're called to labor seem so small and little known?" Yeah, it does to me. But like it also says, it's great if God is in it and he won't forget his own. And so for me, just learning this process of responsibility, it's a weighty responsibility. And asking myself, am I really up to the task? And so this lesson is kind of strange because I started off by just maybe trying to go into ministering. What does it mean to be a minister? And then that kind of led me down a different direction of Joshua and Moses, because one of the first scriptures I came across was how Joshua was Moses's minister. And then I started looking at the generational gap and how, there became a generation that knew not God. And it's like, well, what causes one generation to not be as successful as the one prior? So a lot of that maybe kind of slightly weaved into here. It's kind of, you have to bear with me. So anyways, a minister, it's a chief servant, an agent appointed of God to conduct business and direct the affairs on God's behalf. One who a king or a deity has entrusted his estate and all of his affairs to. It's one who serves. It's one who is called to supply. Someone who gives medicine to the sick. Someone who relieves and to give that which is needful. And so often, I know for me, I can view that job as a minister as a spiritual job. It's my job to feed the flock and to teach them what they need to be taught and to shore up maybe doctrinal things that need to be shorn up. But even as a minister, there's a physical aspect to it as well. A lot of it. I can teach, but really what's going to make me even more effective is physically ministering to my brethren as well. That's going to make my words a lot more effective because my physical ministration to my brethren builds bonds that wouldn't have otherwise been there, and it allows my words as a minister to become that much more powerful. And so, we've done small things. This past winter, we got to dig people out of the snow. There's only a couple of us men in the congregation, so we have, our women that needed to be dug out, and so we'd go over there, load our kids up, and go start shoveling snow. But just really taking on that mentality of a chief servant. And when I think about chief servant, what came to my mind is basically, when you need something, call me, not so much spiritually, but even physically. If you need something as my brother or sister in Christ, I want you to call me first. That's the mindset of a chief servant, one who is just there at the ready. And I thought it was interesting, and I know this, but how so many faithful men of God that he called were first servants. They were shepherds, ministers. And they had proven themselves over time to be selfless, putting others before themselves, proving to God that they could be trusted to put his people and their well-being above their own well-being. And that's what we in this room have shown ourselves to be over time. We've proven to God that we would do that. Whether it's moving somewhere and leaving all, leaving careers, so many things that maybe we have given up, and no doubt we have our flaws, yet God has still chosen us to lead his people. And so, Anyways, I wanted to go to Judges chapter 2, where really picked up at the tail end of Joshua's life, or as Joshua had just passed. And it says there in Judges 2, verse 10. Well, it starts a little bit above that. Verse 7, the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. So, you know, as his generation died out, you know, they served God. But after his generation died out, he goes down in verse 10 to say, all that generation were gathered unto their fathers, and there arose another generation after them, which knew not the Lord, neither the works which he had done for Israel. And it's interesting how the people of God always seem to go as their leaders go. It seems like it's been like that since the beginning of time. It's true for most countries as well. As a leader leads a country, they tend to follow that leader, and they adopt his mentality many times, and they follow his lead. It's true in companies. You know, you have great CEOs, and companies flourish, and you have those that are not so great, and those companies kind of get drained. It's true for families as well. As our families are led by us, so they go, for good or for bad. And leadership really plays a huge role in driving those that are under them, and what they do, how they live their life. And I know it's easy to think, I'm just a man, you know, and my brethren will stand and fall before God on their own. You know, I'm just a man. I don't have anything special about me. But really, this magnifies my responsibility greatly. I'm not just a man. I'm someone God has entrusted to be a faithful minister, to do his will, to guide his people. And history has shown time and time again that people need leaders. They need people to stand in the gap and help provide that direction to them. And that obviously, you know, that somehow fell through here with Joshua. And I thought, why did the generation after Joshua fail? And I just have my own thoughts. My thought was that it was because Joshua didn't really have an understudy, someone who he mentored along the way, like Moses did for him. And I'll get into that maybe in a little bit. But, you know, it seemed to me like Joshua was this faithful man of God. He fought, he taught, he implored the people of God, choose you this day who you will serve. But one of the things I didn't find him doing was mentoring someone to follow in his stead. He was maybe so busy, at least this is my thought, so consumed with the responsibility of leading God's people that he left off picking his replacement. And Moses knew who he was passing the reins to, and that's who it was, Joshua. And, you know, you go look at some of the things, and I've got this a little bit later, and this is where it may be a little out of order here, but ever since Joshua was young, he was groomed for this responsibility that would come. But Joshua, it doesn't seem like, did that to someone else. And very shortly after his death, there arose a generation that knew not God. And it always seems to be the case that the younger generations don't really esteem the older generations as they ought to. I've seen it for myself, and I'm sure some of you have too. Over there in 1 Kings chapter 12, verses 1 through 14, for the sake of time, I'm not going to read it, but it's you know, the account where with Rehoboam and how you know, he sought counsel and how he should lead, and of course he took the counsel of the young. And so you have this congregation or this people that was coming to him, and they're saying, you know, we've got some experience living under your father, and he was hard. He put too much on us. And so if you would just lighten our load a little bit, we will serve you to the end. And so he says, okay, I'll think about it. He goes and he turns to his young friends, and he says, what do you think I should do? And of course they say, you should be harder than your father was. And so he turns around and he takes their advice. And so I thought, this king, because he was so focused on his position, rather than loving the people themselves, he turns and he goes into power trip mode, is really what he did. And he heeds the advice of the youth instead of esteeming the counsel of the wise and the aged. And the younger generation, myself included, can often at times scoff and challenge the way things have always been. Because deep down, sometimes we can think that we have a better or a more efficient way. And we look at the old ways and maybe only look at the negatives to the old ways instead of looking for the positives in those old ways. Why do we do that? I know for me, many times it's a great lacking in understanding. It's being blinded by pride. It's feeling like I have something because I've got this book of knowledge, and many of you older ones have passed on so much knowledge to us younger ones, but one of the things we lack greatly is experience. And so because that lacking in experience is there, there's the connection is just not being made, at least in my mind at times. And so I thought about just learning to see the value in the aged, in older brethren, but not just older brethren in teaching capacities, but just older brethren in general. You know, older people in general have a lot to offer the young. And I have always been one. My son is the same way. He's kind of an old soul. And I've kind of been like that too. I like to talk to older people, and I like to find out what their life is like, what it was like back when you were, you know, cranking up the car with the thing in the front. I used to ask my parents, you know, if they drove a horse and buggy. I had no clue that they grew up, you know, in the 50s. I didn't put all that together. But I've always been, I've always admired the old ways when it comes to life. But I took a visit this past year on our way down to Atlanta for the November trip. I found out that the Alexander Campbell Mansion was only 3 hours from Erie, which was a nice benefit to moving there. And so I wanted to make a stop by there on our way down to Atlanta. So we did. We drove down to Bethany, West Virginia, and we got to tour the house or the mansion of Alexander Campbell. And we got to see... you know, they have his cemetery there, his house, the college that he started, the original or the church building that he designed and they worshiped in and gave his last sermon in. They have the pulpit that he preached at and gave his last sermon at. And he also had a little study off of his house. It was kind of an octagon-shaped study with windows at the top, and that was the only light. And his theme for his study was that he just wanted light from above. Which, of course, would have been from God. And the more you learn about this man, you know, and for some of you that have read some of his writings, I mean, this guy's mind was just amazing. And the words he used were just, you can't even understand half of them. He's just so complex. And you start to hear about what his life was like. Every morning he would wake up and he would walk from his house to his study and he would study and write and do all of these things in the morning before he would walk off to the college to teach, which was some of his profession. And he wrote many things. He was a deep thinker. And I look at myself today, and even though I have so much more at my disposal than he ever did, I don't even hold a candle to his devotion to God. But yet even he didn't pass it on as well as he could have. He had, I believe it was 10 children, and out of his children, none of them seemed to take on the mantle from him. And so I thought about just our society and all of the advancing that we do, all the technology that we have. And, you know, we just have to step back and we look at ourselves and ask ourselves, okay, so we're advancing. You know, there's this movement of growth, and our country's advancing, our world's advancing, the church is advancing, but... then you can stop and say, are we really advancing? Or am I regressing? In some ways, I've advanced, but in other ways, maybe there's been a regression. And I know as a society, we've changed like never before. We're on the cutting edge of so much, but the truth is that we're further from God than we've ever been as well. And so is that really advancement? I think all of us would say no. And so I thought that even in the church, I can fight for liberties, and I can hang on technicalities, and I can say, show me a scripture. But at the same time, if I just stop and ask myself, are you even one-tenth devoted or as devoted as your forefathers, as some of the brethren that went before you, as a Paul or an Alexander Campbell, as a Daniel? Or even as some of our forefathers in this room, are we even that devoted? And I know for myself I have to say no, because I'm not. And so there's this growing problem in society where younger people don't see the value of older people in society. even though the older generation holds expert knowledge. And as a result, they're finding that valuable skills and knowledge are lost on newer generations and will likely die out. And so in all this advancement, men are inventors, they're innovators, they're trailblazers of a new and more efficient way of doing things. Yet when we look back at the old paths, really the generations before us accomplished a lot more than we do in our lives today, I think. You know, we've got all this technology and we do a lot of things faster, but we don't accomplish as much as they did. We're not as deep, you know, in our thoughts perhaps as they did. We don't meditate like they did. There's a lot of things they had in the past generations that we don't. And so in all of our advancements as a society, we've saved a ton of time. But in that same saving of time, we've also lost a lot of fulfillment in our world. People aren't as fulfilled as they used to be. I know we live in a pretty vile world, you know, just to show how bad we're getting. I don't really have to paint the picture because we know. But, you know, the other day at school, my daughter picks up a stapler. And she tells her teacher, you know, where should I put this guy? And some kid in the classroom is like, did you just assume the stapler's gender? I'm like, oh, you have got to be kidding me. Which is where society's going nowadays, you know? It's ridiculous. My daughter has to change in a locker room with a male who has identified as a female. And so they allow him into the girls' locker room, and it's just how it is. We can't do much about it. I know my youngest son, the other day, they said over the intercom, you know, all of the boys who would like to try out for the basketball team, you know, come down to the office or whatever. And this girl gets up, who is in his class, who happens to, sadly, in seventh grade, be a lesbian already. And so she gets up to go out, and he calls her out, like, you're not a boy, sit down. And, you know, for me, I cautioned him, of course, you know, you got to be careful, you're going to get yourself beat up, probably even by a girl. But I liked his heart, you know. It's that heart that sometimes there's a part of you that wants to pull them back from being so forward, but at the same time, maybe that's more of what's needed. And so we see in our world so much dying out at the expense of progression and advancement. Cursive writing is gone, you know, by the wayside. Resourcefulness. People don't really DIY it like they used to back in the days. You know, I mean, some people do, but not to the degree that it used to be. Writing checks? I don't even have a checkbook myself. Some of you may, but I don't. I don't really write checks. And if I need to, I just go to the bank and ask them for a temporary one. Counting money. You've probably experienced this too. You go to the store, you know, that your total is $8.63, and so you give them $10.03, and they're like, I don't need the 3 cents. You know, it's like, no, I want you to take the 3 cents because I'm not trying to get back as many pennies. You know, and they look at you like, what is this for? You know, like, you're the stupid one for giving me more money than you should have. But that's our society. That's where it's all coming, all because we're so advanced. I know one of the things that interests me, and this is just a little side note, is I like hand tool woodworking. I like woodworking. It's fun. But one of the sides I like to it is working with hand tools. Hand tools means that you kind of use the old school things, chisels, hammers, hand planes, you know, hand saws, you know. And not that I don't use power tools because I have them too. But, you know, there's just, even as I'd done research on it, there's so much more fulfillment that just comes from slowing it down and doing it by hand. You know, hearing the saw, you don't create all this sawdust in your shop. You know, you don't have to breathe all that stuff in. It's nice just to slow down and just really kind of handcraft something is really what it boils down to. It's fulfilling. And those are the things that back in the days men did. And nowadays everything is faster, and we see why. We see what happens. If you go, for those of you that have been to IKEA, I mean, yeah, it looks cool. It looks nice. It's cheap, but it's cheap. You know, it falls apart if you move it just one time. But you look at the stuff that people used to make back in the days, and there's furniture still around today from, you know, 200 years ago. Alexander Campbell's pulpit still standing today, you know, back from the 1850s. And so all these advancements, are we really advancing? And I fear that we're not. I think that really we're advancing okay, but we're advancing right into the trap of the devil. And that's his design. His design is to distract us. His design is, you need this right now, instant gratification. And we're gaining more time. But for me, and I'm sure for you, you see that we also misuse time like we've never misused it before as well. So we're creating all this extra time, but we're not using it like we could. And so, and I don't really have a title. That's another thing I realized. I did have a title. It was going to be called One Step Forward and Two Steps Back, but then Jeremy was, we were talking last night, and he's like, I don't really believe there's such a thing as one step forward and two steps back in the church. And he said this before I even told him what my title was going to be. I'm like, oh, okay, better change that up. But, you know, not so much that, you know, for us, but just as a whole, you know, we can get so much done. But am I really hitting the mark? Even as a minister, I can do so many things for the kingdom, but am I really hitting the mark? Am I really doing things with the quality and the attention they need? Am I really affecting hearts like I should? And so what I wanted to share next was something that I've shared a little bit already. I know I shared some of this in San Antonio, in Erie a little bit as well, but it really I thought was good. And it's about slowing down. There's a lot to be said for slowing down and learning to just learning to even fight more for God in my life instead of more for my liberties in my life. And so when we slow down, you know, we start to realize that God doesn't judge on technicalities. He's always judged man on their heart and the effort of a man. You see, I can take even some of the discussions that we've had on travel. And I can work it in such a way to where I can have half the week off if I want to. But it just reveals my heart, doesn't it? And that's the thing, is I can use these technicalities to say, yep, I'm falling in line with the things of God. I'm good with Him. But am I really? Because God doesn't judge me based on how well I technically keep something. He judges my heart. He judges my effort, my motives. And when we slow down, we start to realize a lot more. We realize that I might not get things done as fast, but, you know, what's the rush anyways? What are we really rushing towards? Death, right? Life is not a to-do list. It's not just, you know, my life is not about just checking boxes every day. There's more to life than that. And so I wanted to consider for a moment some of the problems with a rushed and a hurried life. One problem with a rushed and a hurried life is it hinders our ability to properly love other people. Scriptures tell us that love is patient and love suffers long. And in our society today, we don't have time for patience. We need it right now. Patience takes too long because it takes time. And love takes time, doesn't it? You see, without time invested into something, I diminish the capacity I have to truly love that thing. You can't love something that you don't put time into, or you can't love something you don't give time to. And so the more time and attention I give to something, the more my love has the ability to grow, and the more opportunity it has to increase in something. And that's why, you know, we often say that love is spelled T-I-M-E for a reason. But when I'm always rushing, I don't have time, do I? I don't have time to give to my children. I don't have time to give to my brethren as much. It's rushed. It's hurried. I got to hurry up and get this done so I can move on to the next thing on my list. And in doing so, I can't really build those bonds. I can't love you. And the time I do end up giving people is really spent unfocused. It's spent contemplating the next thing I've got to do. And so relationships, as a result, grow cold and stale. And in time, we're left with nothing because we didn't give time. Another problem with a rushed and a hurried life is that it increases the power of temptation. You see, Satan is the master of temptation and manipulation. And Satan's whole goal is to make us believe that we need gratification right now, instant gratification. It's our the motto of our society today. But what that has done is it shortens the time between impulse and action. Every time, you know, we see something that we want to do, there's an impulse. And what should happen is there should be a time of consideration. Think it through. Is this really a wise idea? Is this something I really want to get myself into? Is if I say it like this, what effect is that going to have on somebody? But when you take time out of the equation, you go from impulse to action a lot quicker, which means you make a lot of bad choices, which means you put your foot in your mouth more, you hurt people more because you're not slowing down to just really think about the effects of maybe an action. And that's why even in our world, people have increased in temptation. They fall for all sorts of vices, and so can we fall into temptation because we are leaving time out of the equation to the degree that it should. We're not thinking things through. And I know that's been true for me too. Another thing that it does is it causes us to have a knowledge of God, but it prevents me from knowing God. And that's something that I really, in my life, want to really focus a lot more on. It's just knowing God. You know, the Pharisees had knowledge, but yet at the same time, they were instrumental in crucifying Christ. Why? Because in spite of knowing about God, they didn't know God. And that can be us. It can be me and you, or we can have a lot of knowledge of the scriptures, of the inner workings of the church, of how to make a judgment, but yet because we're so rushed and we don't really take the time, we really don't know God. And it's easy to sit down and say, okay, I've got a midweek class I've got to prepare for. And so I sit down before class and I throw some things together, you know, that make sense. And I study it out, think about myself in it, whatever. And you've got something to share, but do you really know God? You know? And I know for me, that's where you see I don't like I should. Another thing about time, when we're so rushed in our life, is that we end up with misplaced purposes. And I know in our society today, purpose is it's one of these buzzwords that's like, you know, living a purpose-driven life. That's what it's all about. You know, find your purpose, find your passion. And our world has defined purpose. They've kind of redefined the term purpose. To the world, purpose is it's what we do. It's the things that our five senses can experience. So if I can touch it, if I can see it, hear it, smell it, visit it, then that is purpose. You know, I'm going to go travel the world. You know, that to them, that's purpose. But purpose is really all about pursuing the man within. God's idea of purpose is not about doing stuff, but it's about becoming something. It's not about, you know, what I can go out and do with my life, but it's what I can become as a man. And so it's not about, you know, this going here, going there. It's about transformation. And in a rushed life, we look outward for answers to life. We look outward for fulfillment. But when we slow down and start to really realize what God wants us to do, all of the things that God has designed is for us to find the answers within, which is exactly like my conversation with Julio. That's what he's found, you know, and it's so edifying just hearing it. The answer isn't what's out there. So often you can feel like that. It's like, you know, your kids want, you know, we're new to Erie, and so I wanted to kind of keep them entertained. I don't want them to, you know, hate the place because I don't want them to leave me, which they may end up doing anyways. Who knows? But it's like I can go out there and I can buy jet skis and I can, you know, buy a boat and do all of these things with them. But really, that's just teaching them that you can find fulfillment in all this stuff. That's not where it's found. It's found by finding ourselves. Even Christ, our example, showed us to slow down. He had a very busy life, just like we do. But Christ did not live a hurried life. And there's a big difference between being in a hurry and being busy. Christ made time to be alone with God. And I've always enjoyed the scripture in Mark chapter 1, verse 35, where I'll just read it. Mark chapter 1, 35. It says, "In the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out. and departed into a solitary place, and there he prayed. And I know Christ, on purpose, created this space in his life where he could slow down and connect with God. And I know for me, I don't do that. It's so easy to just wake up and run into the day. You wake up, got to get the kids to school. You know, you do all sorts of things before you finally sit down and take a breather. That's not the way that our lives ought to be. Christ, you know, shows us by example that time alone with God is crucial. And I can find myself being so busy, you know, that the first time I connect with God, it's after the kids are gone to school. And it's like, wow, is this my first prayer of the day? Yep, sure is, you know, and you've already been awake for a while. One of the things that even intimacy requires in a relationship is alone time. It requires attention. It requires peace and quiet from the distractions of life. You can't build a strong relationship without that. You know, Psalms 46:10 tells us to be still and know that I am God. And so to develop this relationship with God that I desire, it's going to require alone time and attention, which means I've got to create that time, which means I've got to pull back from something or slow myself down so that I can truly connect with him. And when I slow down, I'm able to learn from nature. I'm able to see myself better. I'm able to make better judgments. I commune with my God. I invest more into relationships. The work that I do is much higher quality than the work I do when I'm rushed. And when I do, God is pleased. When I slow down, I use my time wisely. And when I waste time, which I so often can do, when I waste time, I'm not just losing time. And that's the thing that I've come to realize that, you see, wasting time is not the loss of time. It's a loss of opportunity. That's really what you're losing when we waste time. Because you only get one chance at so many things in life. So I can waste an hour and say, oh, I wasted that hour. You know, but really, what opportunities did I waste in that hour? Opportunities that can never be recovered. I know my oldest is finishing high school. She graduates in a month. And I wasted time, sure. And not all that time I wasted while she was young is irrecoverable. But, you know, the worst part about it is that her childhood's over, and I can't go back and do it over. You see, there's times where we can recover lost time by working harder at something. You know, maybe at work, I waste an hour at work, and so it's like, okay, I work really hard for the next hour to catch back up. But you can't do that with opportunities. I can't just say, well, you know, she's 18. Let me just work really hard for the next year and fix all the time I wasted the last 18 years. No, can't do that. You cannot recover lost opportunity. I know even working with, you know, our newest babe, that's one of the things that that sometimes in the back of your mind, it's like responsibility seems like it's calling. We don't have a lot of personal workers in Erie, and really it's just me and Thomas that go out on the personal work. And so, you know, you could easily take on that mentality. Well, like I worked with Zach for 4 months. I didn't go on personal work for 4 months, working with him, trying to, I mean, that was my personal work. So it wasn't like I didn't go, but that was it. And so then he gets baptized, and it's like, okay, now I can be back out on the personal work. But I don't want to do that. I want to keep working with him, at least for, you know, a little bit longer, because to me, it's like, okay, look, just, I can rush back into personal work, get back out there knocking on doors, and I can kind of leave some loose ends, and then he ends up becoming this Christian who doesn't get fed like he needs. He becomes weak and falls away. Or I can slow it down and realize that, okay, do I really have to just rush right back out there, you know, and knock on doors? Or can this continue to be my work so that he can be strong? So that when that work is left, you know, you're not later on having to go back and, you know, do even more work. And so I want to just spend that time with him. And my kids too, you know, just taking more of that time with them. Don't feel like I've got to just hurry up and get things done. I know one of the things that was not done with me was that very same thing. Time wasn't really taken with me when I was young, you know, by my father when I was a Christian. You know, I didn't get worked with, you know, like we work with people now. And I wish I would have. But It's neither here nor there now. I thought that I've got to let go of my time and realize that my effect as a minister and my legacy that I leave is not in all the things that I do, but it's in who I touch. So, you know, it's easy to sit back and feel like I've got all these things I've got to get done as a minister, and I've got to do this and that and preach this. And, you know, we can get overwhelmed by the to-do list. But when we're gone from this life, it doesn't matter how much we accomplished. Really, what matters more so is how many people I touched, how many lives I affected for the better, how many people are on their way to heaven because of my work. And maybe slowing down helps me to do that, not feel like I've got to just move right on to the next thing, but let me just focus on giving this the right amount of attention before I move on from it. So, passing it on. I'm going to try to rush through some of this, but passing it on. I tried to research generational gaps and differences. What caused one generation not to pass on something to the next? And what I found in the little research I did was that mentoring and teaching were the two top methods of making sure that the next generation got what they needed. Duplication and shadowing, you know, not just telling somebody what to do or what the standard is, but really just almost holding their hand and letting them shadow you along through this life. Having two or more people do the same role, creating opportunities for other people to grow and learn in that new role. And it's so hard to do. It's very hard to do because you can feel like I've got so much to do, yet if I slow down and I teach this one how to do this, you know, you might not do it right. You might not do it to the degree that I can, or I can do it quicker. I know with my children, I can do that with maybe a project. My intent is to start by working on a project with them. I know we just recently built a new pulpit for our congregation, and we started off with this grand idea of getting our kids involved, which was, you know, a good idea. And then we got our kids involved and realized this might go a lot slower than we thought. And you know, time was of the essence, and it's like, okay, we'll get to the kids later. We'll do some other projects with them down the road. Let's just hurry up and get this thing done. And that's kind of, you know, the mentality that can really prevent the next generation from getting what they need. Because, you know, if I do that, if I just rush through the project so I can hurry up and get it done, my kids don't learn how to maybe use a tool. They don't learn the proper use of it, or they don't learn, you know, some new technique or something. You know, they're not getting a hands-on experience. I know for me, my dad was a carpenter, and I didn't get the hands-on experience from him. Otherwise, I probably would have been one. I enjoy woodworking. I like it, but every time I'd go on a project with him, I was the cleanup guy, you know, because he was always maybe trying to get something done that I never got to really learn how to do things. You know, I loved it when I got to maybe use a drill and screw something into the wall, but it just didn't happen. So it really comes down to taking on more of a mentality of I've got to pass this not just this knowledge, but I've got to pass this skill on. I've got to really make a concerted effort to give the next generation what I've got. And when I say that, you know, it's more so, you know, for me, I take it for my children, being able to give them what I have and realizing, okay, you can knock out this project super quick and get it done off your to-do list, or you can slow it down and you can give them something that they will take with them to the next generation that affects your grandchildren. I know in Erie, I was, at first when we were going to move there, I kind of wanted June and Trent to leave right away. It's like, y'all go, and we'll come in and just have this little break, you know? I just thought at first that might be best. But we ended up having, I think it was 5 months of overlap. And I'm really glad that we did, because it was great. Number one, we got to create bonds and a relationship that we will take with us, you know, till the day we pass. But it really helped even with just understanding the congregation. And now I did tell them when I got there, I don't want to know about, people's problems or situation. I kind of wanted to figure people out for myself. I didn't want to be told this one's like this and this one's like that, because I wanted to just kind of come up with my own views on things. But the overlap really helped with just understanding the congregation, better, giving us that time to kind of acclimate, and kind of get our feet wet. And so you just see that even in that, there's this little somewhat of a mentoring before there's this split. And okay, I'm supposed to have about 5 minutes. Let's see. Okay. A mentor seeks to always impart a lesson, not just give a lesson. And there's a big difference, I think we've it's not a hard concept to understand. I've got to be able to impart this to you, to really connect the dots for you to see, not just give you a lesson so I can, again, check it off my to-do list, but to really make sure you got the lesson. I know I was just even thinking about this topic that we've got of travel. And, it's an issue that it's kind of funny, because last night I was talking to my wife about some of the things we were talking about. And she was driving home with my daughter from work, and she was telling my daughter just kind of what we had talked about. And the first thing my daughter says is like, oh, it sounds like more rules. And I was like, yeah, kind of like Tom had said. And it's like she's missing the point. The point is, it's not about all these do's and don'ts. It's learning to cultivate in us a heart for the things of God first. And when you do that, you don't even need to worry about all that stuff. Keep going, don't cheat us. I already skipped some things, but I won't skip any more. How about that? I was thinking just about, even when we get back to Erie, how am I going to teach this? And I thought, my job is to give my congregation not a list of situations that are permissible and situations that aren't, because really that's the judgment. My role is to give them the ability to make that judgment for themselves without really having to ask me, per se. And so I thought, what might help with doing something like that? And what I thought was, okay, what I want to do is I want to have a class when we get back after, we go over everything. I want to have a class on the importance of my role to the church. And I want everybody to study that out for themselves. Figure out, why is what I do important to the church? How am I an asset to the church? And why am I so needed in my congregation? Because I feel like if people really study that out for themselves, what they're going to learn is that they're going to develop in themselves more of a sense of responsibility to the church. I was talking to my wife about this, and I was just thinking, it's like, I mean, would any of us who have a child, let's say you've got a 5-year-old child, would you just up and leave and go on a trip and just leave your 5-year-old behind? Of course not. But we would stop, because we love them and because we have a sense of responsibility to them, and we would make sure that they had the adequate care. We would also make sure that we weren't gone too long, because we don't want to, that relationship needs to be cultivated by the parent. I can't be away from them for such a long time. And so we'd be quick to get back. We'd do our business and get back. And why would we do that? Because of love, because of obligation, a sense of responsibility to this one. And if I could cultivate in my brethren, in myself, in my children, that same mentality, that the church has to become like my baby. It has to become my life, my love, the thing that I hold in the highest of esteem. And when it does, then there's no question about when can I go, when can't I go, how long should I go. It's just going to come naturally that I'm not going to want to be gone too long. I'm going to want to be back. I've got responsibilities that that really need to be there. And even for me, you know, working with my kids, because I like to teach my kids these things too. I don't like to just teach the brethren, because I want my kids to have this understanding as well. But just even, there's so many scriptures in the Bible, so many accounts of just what we've signed up for, you know, that no man having put his hand to the plow looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. My life is not my own, that people left all and followed God. And it's so clear that this is what we should be fighting for, not a liberty. I know another thing when it comes to just kind of mentoring or passing on to the next generation some things. I try to do that with my kids, and I have done a decent job with one of my, well, not one of my children. I've tried to do a decent job with all of them, but I found that I've really focused on one of them, probably to a fault, because the other ones could use a little bit more of my attention. But taking them with me on personal work, working side by side through things. You know, just the other day I heard my kids signed up for the fellowship list. I was like, what? You know, it's like my son was going to bring $25 worth of wings to the fellowship. My daughter signed up for a drink. You know, I didn't tell them to do that, but somehow they got in their mind that they wanted to do that. Now, where does that come from? I think just mentoring them along, just showing them that this life can be exciting, trying to excite them about this life. And I've really tried to do that with Christianity, is I've tried to make it exciting to my children. I don't want them to think that this is some boring and dull life. I want them to see that it can be fun. We can have excitement. I know one of the things that we love to do, and I feel like there's probably a lot of my life that's out of order because of this. I'm not really good with structure per se. I don't have a bedtime, neither do my kids. We just kind of do what we do, you know, after Tuesday or Wednesday night class. A lot of times we'll just go out to Wendy's, and we'll go as almost like as a congregation. We'll go out, we'll get, you know, some Frosties and a bite to eat, and the kids enjoy it. They sit together and chat. The brethren enjoy it. It's just spending time together, it just makes us more excited to be around each other. And I think it's things like that that have put somewhat of an excitement in my kids. You know, I got one that's 18 now, and I'm trying to learn what some of you guys have learned. You know, how do you get them baptized without being pushy and saying stuff about it? I've tried to back off. I don't want to push her. I want her to do it on her time, because that's another thing that I feel like I learned growing up in the church is I want my kids to do it for the right reasons. Sometimes I look back on my life and when I made the decision to become a Christian, and I wish I could do some things differently with it. And I don't want my kids I want them to do it because they're ready for God, that they want to serve God. There's this desire to really begin to follow him, not because, you know, dad's pricking their conscience and it's like, well, yeah, okay, I should. Not that that's not needed. But I know another thing is, even my kids, when I would go meet with Zach before he became a Christian, my daughter would always ask me, how'd it go with Zach? What do you say? You know, how's he sound? You know, they're just always excited about where things were going with him. One of my other kids had recently went to another congregation to visit for a little bit, and one of the brothers there called me and told me, you know, just how his visit went, that they enjoyed him, things like that. But he said one thing about him is he talks like he's a Christian. He's telling us about Erie, and he's saying, like, yeah, we baptized, you know, somebody the other day, and yeah, we decided this in our class or whatever. It's like everything was we instead of, you know, the church. You know, it's just, I don't know. That's how he talks, because that is his life. But it's been put in him from a young age as well. I know one of the things my kids have always kind of harped on me about, not harped on me, but when they see somebody sitting alone, like, Dad, so-and-so's, you know, not being talked to, go talk to him. And I'm always like, okay, I mean, you know, kind of like I'm in the middle of a conversation with somebody, but it's maybe a group conversation. So I kind of go over there and do it. And now I get to return the favor to them because in Erie, you know, there's kids there, and there happens to be one kid who's quiet, doesn't really talk to the other kids a whole lot. And so I'll go up to my kids, and I'm like, hey, yeah, somebody's over there and need to be talked to. And they do. They go over there, and they've really tried to draw him in. And it's been neat. It's been neat to see. I thought about some of the types of mentoring relationships we see in Scripture. And not one of them that comes to mind is a king mentoring his successor. Not once do you ever find a king mentoring the next guy. At least I didn't really see it. And I didn't really, like, you know, look as hard as I could have. But often what a king focused on was their leadership. They focused on their leadership role while they reigned, but they didn't focus enough on passing the mantle. And perhaps that's why so often you don't really ever find more than a couple good kings in succession. It just wasn't really the norm. So often they seem to march to the beat of their own drum. You know, they just, I'm going to live, I'm going to serve, you know, in this kingdom. I'm going to live how I want to live at this moment. And then the next guy, he gets to worry about whatever he has to worry about when that time comes. Whereas other relationships in Scripture, we see more of a mentoring approach, like Elijah with Joshua, Elijah and Elisha, or Moses and Joshua, you know, Peter and Christ, or Timothy and Paul. But these men weren't rulers. Therefore, their leadership took a much different approach. And so I thought that the ones who weren't rulers, per se, but they viewed it as more of a spiritual leading first and a physical leading second, because they had a different mentality than a king. A king's mentality was to rule, whereas Elijah and Moses and men like this, their mentality was to spiritually lead. And that's the mentality I have to really pass on to my children and to the next generation. What it is that's really important is not just, I'm a dad, you got to listen to me, but spiritually leading them, really trying to draw them in that way is really going to be where I connect the dots for them. A mentor is a wise and trusted counselor. It's an influential figure in someone's life. A mentor is also someone who guides, who advises, or who trains. And the word train means to draw along or to educate, to teach or to form someone by instruction and by practice. Not just by instruction, but by practice as well. And this is really the last kind of part of my lesson. It kind of comes to an abrupt end, to beware. In Proverbs chapter 22, verse 6, it says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." And I have, again, I've shared this, I think, in San Antonio. But in my Bible, next to that scripture is the word catechize. And I saw that word, and I looked it up, and I was amazed by its definition. I love the definition of this word, catechize. It means to instruct by asking questions, receiving answers, and offering explanations or corrections. It is to question, to examine, or to try by questions, and elicit answers from a person which condemn his own conduct or convict him as to what is right. And so I thought about maybe just talking for a moment about using questions to my advantage. Because as a minister, that is something that really I can use at my disposal, and it's a really awesome tool. And so I can teach my brethren, let's say, about discretion. And I can teach them all the things to do with discretion. This is what we don't wear. This is why this is indiscreet, you know, and show them all the scriptures on discretion. Or I can question them on it. You know, maybe I just start off by asking, what is discretion? You know, what do you think it means to be chaste? Of course, I may know the answers, but asking the question really shows me where they are, how they think, how they process things, or how they view things. And as a minister or as a parent, it really gives me invaluable information as to where I need to go or what my future instruction needs to be. I know even with Zach, our newest babe, at first he was pretty hard to crack. You know, he's one of those guys that just is like, will you talk? You know, I feel like I'm just asking all these questions. And he's like, yes, no. You know, it's like kind of short answers to the questions. But as time went on, I mean, now he's like, he's so open. He's asking questions. He's talking. You don't have to, you know, pull things out of him as much, because the questions help just open things up. It helped us to get to know each other. It helped us to build a bond. I learned what he likes, what he doesn't like. And as I learn those things, I'm able to use them. He likes hunting and guns. I've never hunted in my life, but I'm going to do it this year. And so we started talking about guns. I started, you know, maybe researching what types of guns I should get. I started asking him for his advice. What do you think I should get? You know, and it just kind of created this relationship that I think he felt we could just really communicate well and just talk, and he could talk to me about anything. But it started with questions, lots of questions. And so I was going to title this lesson, well, the original topic I was going to go into was called The Art of the Question, which I would like, you know, because I at first I was thinking, oh, there's not really a whole lot you can go into on that, but yeah, you can do a whole lesson on The Art of the Question. How many questions are there in the Bible? In the Bible, there's 3,294 questions. And interestingly enough, the first question that we find in Scripture is in Genesis chapter 3 and verse 1. And it was Satan questioning God, trying to get Eve to fall for, you know, his thing. You know, and drawing a blank now, so I got to read it. Genesis 3:1. So he says, yea, hath God said, ye shall not eat of every tree of the garden? First question. And I thought about, you know, interesting how even Satan uses this approach to try to get us to what? Doubt, question something, think about something a little bit harder or whatever. It's a tactic that has been used often. And I looked up, I tried to research the different types of questions that there are. There's probably more, but there's four types of questions. There's closed questions, open questions, loaded questions, and rhetorical questions. And a closed question is a question that is used to force a brief one- or two-word answer. Often the answer is right or it's wrong. Often they're used early on in conversation. They're crucial in fact-finding. And that's what Satan used in the very first question in Scripture. It was a yes or no answer. And these questions are the ones we use with our kids. Did you clean your room? You know, do you have homework today? Do you understand what I'm saying? Do you believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Again, this question that is closed. And then you have open questions. Open questions allow for much longer responses, and they tend to have more creativity come from them. More information comes back to the person asking the question. It's like, what do you think this scripture means? Well, now all of a sudden they've got to give an explanation. What advice can you give me on raising teens? Well, that's not a very short answer. You know, and I asked Gary and Stuart the other day, if you could go back to the time you were 35, what would you do differently if given the chance? You're going to get more than just a quick answer. And then there's loaded questions. And loaded questions are usually questions where the motive is somewhat hidden. There's an agenda of the person asking the question. These tend to be a lot more subtle. How was your day? Versus, you know, what's the highlight of your day? See, if you say, how was your day? Good, bad, it was all right. But what was the highlight of your day? Well, now I'm forcing the person to think about something positive about their day. What was my highlight? Now they're thinking positive. Now they're going to give you a more thoughtful answer instead of just, how was your day? Good. It's all right. And we do that when we talk to each other. How you doing? I'm all right. I'm good. Not even thinking about it. And later on you walk away, am I really good? sometimes I'm like, wow, I spoke too soon. But that's a loaded question. You're trying to drive the answer into a specific direction. You're more focused on driving a certain way of thinking in the person. And that's what Satan did in the garden. You know, even though it was a closed question to a degree. It was really a loaded question. He was really trying to get Eve to question God. And so that's what loaded questions can be, where you're really trying to get the person to consider something. We can ask all these questions when people come for counsel. You know, it's like, I can tell you the answer, or I can ask you questions. And if I ask you questions, then guess what? You come to the conclusion that this is right, or this is wrong, or this is what I should do. And that person walks away convicted in their own mind as to what they ought to do, instead of them getting it from me and feeling like, here goes another rule, here goes, you know, so-and-so telling me what I have to do. Now you're the one who's coming up with that conclusion, all based on the way I ask the question. And then finally, there's rhetorical questions. Can fish swim? Or can birds fly? Or this one I found, if you set out to fail and you're successful, have you failed or succeeded? And these are questions that we ask, and you don't really expect much of an answer back. It may be a question that really doesn't have an answer, or may have a very obvious answer. And Paul used these kinds of questions often in his writings. And at Romans 8:31, he said, if God be for us, who can be against us? He didn't mean for them to answer that per se. It's a rhetorical question. It's making a point. Romans 6:1, shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? Or 1 Corinthians 11:22, with the Lord's Supper. You know, they weren't doing things as they ought to with it. And he tells them, shall I praise you in this? I praise you not. He wasn't looking for an answer back, but it's this rhetorical question. And one person in Scripture that was masterful at this, as we all know well, was Christ. I just love the way that he answered people and the way that he confounded people with such simplicity so many times. And in Matthew chapter 22, verse 15 to 22, it says, then went the Pharisees and took counsel how they might entangle him in his talk. So you talk about ulterior motives, here you go. And they sent unto him their disciples with the Herodians, saying, Master, we know that thou art true and teachest the way of God in truth, and you care not for any man, nor regard the person of man. Tell us, therefore, what thinkest thou? Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar? Now, you talk about a loaded question. They're building him up as to, you know, well, I know you're really this way, and I know this is what's right. Now let me ask you the question to try and entrap you. But Jesus perceived their wickedness and said, why tempt ye me, ye hypocrites? He said, show me the tribute money. And they brought him a penny. And he said unto them, whose is this image and superscription? They said unto him, Caesar's. And he said unto them, render therefore unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's. And when they heard this, they marveled and left him and went their way. Just a simple question. Whose image is on that penny? Well, Caesar's. Okay, give him the things that are due to him, and give to God the things due to God. It's pretty simple. But just with one question, he shut them down and caused them to walk away marveling at his wisdom. He used questions at other times to confound people. Down at the end, verses 41 through 46, the Pharisees were gathered together, and Jesus asked them, he said, what think you of Christ? Whose son is he? And they said unto him, the son of David. And he said unto them, well, how then does David in the spirit call him Lord, saying, the Lord said unto my Lord, sit thou on my right hand till I make thine enemies a footstool? If David then call him Lord, how is he his son? And they didn't have no answer, walked away confounded. He was masterful at using these questions to his advantage. And Christ shows us the power in questions and how they can be used artfully to accomplish a purpose. And as a minister, so can I, and so can you. Learning the value of just asking the question, asking multiple questions, asking questions that you may already know the answer to, but you want them to come up with the answer so that you know where they're at. At the doors on personal work, you know, we use these questions to drive thought and responses so that I can have a dialogue, not a monologue. See, if I'm doing all the talking, it's just a monologue. But if I'm using questions to drive my conversation, it becomes this back and forth dialogue that really drives the conversation and brings about what's really needed. Now I know what I need to teach you on. I know where you're at. And it's an extremely powerful tool in the life of a minister. Questions really accomplish a lot. They give the one asking the question knowledge that they hope to obtain, but they also provoke thought on the part of the hearer. So it's kind of a two-part thing that it does. It really is a powerful thing because it gives me what I need to know about you, but it also provokes thought in you that will cause something to come forth. And in Ecclesiastes chapter 1:13, I'm almost done. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 13. And I think this is what this means because this is how I've understood it. But Solomon says, I gave my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all things that are done under heaven. This sore travail has God given to the sons of men to be exercised therewith. I think the sore travail that he's talking about is this desire, this heart to seek and search out concerning all wisdom, this need to know why, this need to figure life out, which is a question, right? I'm questioning life. What is life all about? What is my purpose? What am I doing here? This sore travail, he says, God gave us so that we could exercise ourselves. God gave us this inquisitive, questioning, seeking heart within us so that we can seek and search out wisdom, so that we can find answers to the questions that we have at our core. And Ecclesiastes is full of questions. It's a man who is trying to figure out and find fulfillment and purpose in life. And so what he starts to do, you've all read the book of Ecclesiastes, he goes in and he starts to question things, and he's trying to figure life out. He asks himself a question, and then he pursues the answer, and he tries to prove something out. He says, one of the first questions he asks, I said of mirth, what doeth it? You know, or I said in my heart, what happens to the fool? You know, this also happens to me. And then he says, well, why was I more than the wise? Why was I more than wise? It's like, as he starts to really ask himself these questions, he starts to come to these conclusions that, why am I like this? If I'm going to die just like the poor man, why am I seeking all this wealth? If I'm going to be just like the fool, why is it that I'm seeking after all this wisdom? It's causing him to really figure life out by asking himself these questions. And so at the end of all of this seeking and questioning, and all of his wisdom that he seeks to find, he arrives at one final conclusion at the end, which you know, Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14, fear God and keep his commandments, for God shall bring every work into judgment. I mean, that's really what it boils on down to, is all these questions, this sore travail that even God gave us as a tool so that we could figure life out. It's designed to help us arrive at the same conclusion that Solomon did, that life is about fearing God and keeping his commandments, because one day every work will be brought into judgment. And so questions are powerful, because ultimately what they do is they start the ball rolling towards a solution. That's what questions are, is they provide a solution when you get the answer. And so as a minister, I can ask myself questions. Where can I serve my congregation better? Now I get to go find a solution, right? I get to go figure out how and where. How can I touch the heart of this child? How can I make our personal work more effective? How can I be a more loving husband? Where do I lack towards my spouse or my children? Where am I falling short in pleasing my God? Which I've already, we start to find answers this week to that. How can I overcome my lust or my pride? Isn't that what study is? And study is nothing more than a series of questions that I ask that I seek the answers to, and I find those answers or those solutions. So that's pretty much it. I told you it'd come to an abrupt end. So thank you.